This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On July 5, 1852, abolitionist and former slave Frederick Douglass stood before an audience of the Ladies' Anti-Slavery Sewing Society in Rochester, New York. He had been charged with giving a 4th of July oration. But what Douglass delivered was a rebuke. His speech, titled The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro, explored ideas of race, racism, independence, and a broken promise. Here's just a small part of the speech, read by actor Morgan Freeman for a special on the History Channel.
This 4th July is yours, not mine. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America.
For the last several years, an event has been staged in Boston Common marking the 4th of July. It's a communal reading of that speech by Frederick Douglass. Last year, the Vermont Humanities Council brought the speech to Vermont, and this year there are 13 communities participating in the event. Paul Marcus organized the project. He says the Douglass speech adds depth to our celebrations of American independence, and he's back with us today to talk more about why this speech still resonates. Paul, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're also joined today by Jane Williamson, who runs the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. The Rokeby explores the history of one family, the Robinson family, and the Underground Railroad in Vermont. Nice to have you back on the show, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe we could start by getting a little bit more background on who Frederick Douglass was and why he might have been asked to give a 4th of July oration in Rochester in 1852. Paul Marcus, why don't you start?
Sure. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery. His exact birth date isn't known. He chose February 14th to mark his birth date, but the year and the actual date isn't known. He was really raised by his grandmother. He hardly knew his mother. He has memories of his mother and his grandmother raised him. He was passed on to the Y House Plantation in Maryland, and after the overseer there passed away, he was sold to given to a woman named Lucretia Auld, and then was sent to her husband's brother's home in Baltimore, and at that home, the wife of her husband's brother began to teach him the alphabet, and he became very interested in reading. And it's interesting, there was one point where her husband caught her teaching him and deeply scolded her and talked about how if people who were enslaved would learn how to read, that they wouldn't, they understand their situation. And he later on mentioned that that was his first anti-slavery, first hint of an anti-slavery speech. Huh. He then continued, he taught himself to read. One very powerful influence on him was the Columbia Reader, which was an anthology used in schools to teach students grammar and writing. And it was an anthology of speeches and writings. And he later said that in fact, began to really help him clarify his views on human rights. I'll skip through this very quickly. He eventually escapes. Prior to escaping, he fell in love with a woman in Baltimore who was a free black woman who gave him a sense. And this is after two unsuccessful tries. And he escapes. He ends up very briefly in New York and then settles in New Bedford, where the woman he knew from Baltimore came up and they married. He gets involved with the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church in New Bedford, after seeing that the white Methodist Church was segregated. Becomes a licensed minister in 1839, or a licensed preacher, works at the church as a sexton, runs the Sunday school program, begins to shape his oratory skills. And then He's also joining a number of organizations and is very much involved with abolitionist organizations. Is very much impressed with the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, and there's a whole interesting history we might talk about a little bit later on about that. But initially, Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator, is profoundly influential on Garrison, on Douglas, and he actually goes to see Garrison speak in 1840. And then Garrison is also, by this time, been very impressed with Douglas. And Douglas is, at some point after that, unexpectedly asked to speak at a meeting. And he gets up and speaks about his history and his life as a slave. And he's then encouraged to become an anti-slavery lecturer.
Well, so let me stop you there, and we'll go through and tease apart a little bit more of this history and how Frederick Douglass came to be such a popular speaker and such a well-known figure. By 1852, he was a freed slave, and his star had risen not only in the United States, but also over in England, where he had gone to speak, and some British people had bought his freedom at that time. So he was now a freed slave. Jane Williamson, oddly, from what I've been hearing, that wasn't something that every abolitionist was really in favor of at the time. Why would they be upset that he had been freed by the payments of some English abolitionists?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. Some of the radical abolitionists who believed that slavery was a sin, a lot of the motivation behind their campaign came from their very deep religious beliefs. So for them, and this includes Rowland Robinson at Rokeby, contributing funds to the purchase of a slave, even for his liberation, was seen as a sin. We have an instance at the museum, a young fugitive slave who lived and worked there for a year, saved up $150 to buy his freedom. And then the offer was made to his former owner. He wanted twice that amount. He wanted $300. And Robinson wouldn't contribute the missing $150, though he certainly could have, because it was recognizing a principle which God forbids. So for a lot of the abolitionists, it was part of their, you know, the core of their abolitionist beliefs. And then there was also, I think, something a little bit less lovely. He had kind of more cachet as a fugitive slave, I think, for some people. The abolitionists, Douglas and Garrison were very close for a while, but race is a terrible thing. Racism is a terrible thing, and it really can mess up even some of the most close associations and friendships. And I think when he first began speaking, some people felt Douglas was too eloquent. He spoke too well. He spoke in a, shall we say, more white kind of a voice. They wanted him to put on a little more Southern, slavey, whatever, which was hugely offensive to him, as you can understand. Anyway, so there are all those issues, I think, also kind of rumbling around. And then when he came back, he also came not only with his own freedom, he came with funds to start his own newspaper. That riled them up as well. So, yeah.
So that was sort of the scene in 1852.
Well, that had happened 5 years earlier. Mm-hmm. By then, he'd gone out to Rochester. You know, a lot had changed.
You just mentioned that he was an eloquent speaker, and you can certainly see that if you read the text of The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro. He was incredibly gifted. But I found it humorous that he gives a warning at the beginning of that speech that he's not going to use flowery language, or as he says in that sentence, high-sounding exordium. And then he says, oh, I'm not a very gifted speaker, but clearly he was. Paul Marcus, that's just something it sounds like he really developed on his own after being taught the alphabet?
He really did. I mean, he was self-taught as a reader, and he was a gifted speaker. And, you know, I think also his, preaching, he was also a very religious man, and I think his preaching had a great influence on his oration as well.
We're talking today about the role Frederick Douglass played in the abolitionist movement. We're also going to be talking about why he didn't think Vermont was a beacon of freedom when he visited in 1843. Listeners, we'd like to know what you know about Frederick Douglass. Do you see connections between his famous speech and today's continuing race issues? You can share your thoughts with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So let's dive into this speech, the meaning of July 4th for the Negro. It's a very long speech, but maybe each of you can highlight a few important passages or facets that you think are really special. Jane, we'll start with you.
Well, he really took this opportunity. I mean, he acted like he was insulted, and I think maybe he actually was insulted to be asked to speak. You know, and they probably thought he would get up and say, oh, how wonderful the United States of America and the Declaration of Independence and the land of the free and liberty. And
because this was supposed to be a 4th of July oration.
Right. So he says, sorry, I see no reason for me to do that. And he instead took it as an opportunity to say all of the things that don't often get said. And particularly not at that time. I mean, to say all those things on that occasion meant people would be listening. More people might be listening to him. And he really, you know, I just was reading some passages from it this morning. He really calls out the United States.
Explain more for people who are unfamiliar with the speech. What's he doing in it?
Well, he's condemning the United States. He calls our liberty a sham. Why would you ask me? Why would you ask me of all people that you could think of? Why would you ask me? So he wants to speak from the slave's point of view, which he does very well, and just, you know, really slams the United States.
Paul, pick up from there.
Well, I think it's also important to think about the context of the of 1850. So, you know, at the time of the speech, there's over 3 million blacks enslaved in the U.S. There'd be 4 million by the end of the decade. In 1840, cotton produced by slave labor constituted over 59% of U.S. exports. In 1860, slaves were an asset that was worth more than all of the country's manufacturing, all the railroads, all the productive capacities of the U.S. put together. You know, a system that built the finance, you know, New York as a financial power becomes a financial power because of enslavement. You know, the Lehman Brothers were cotton dealers. And so it's in that context, and it's interesting because it's a brilliant speech because he actually begins the speech by praising the founding fathers. He talks about, you know, he talks about what they did was really quite amazing, and he does that to build the case, and it's a case that African Americans have been making since the Declaration of Independence was written, and that is how, you know, it's naming the hypocrisy. That how can you be talking about freedom and being enslaved by England while you're enslaving Africans on our shores and killing Native Americans? And so he begins with that piece, but then he has that shift that Jane was talking about. He says, are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And then that's where he leads into the 4th of July is yours, not mine. And he says that the real subject of his speech is American slavery. And then he sets up, you know, he names the contradiction, and it's the contradiction that's at the founding of our nation. He then later on in the speech, it takes on opponents, these sort of theoretical opponents of the speech. And he it's interesting because he says that. He said, there's no person on earth who would be in favor of himself becoming a slave himself. How can it be, therefore, that some people are in favor of imposing a condition on others that they would not impose on themselves? And then he goes on and excoriates the religious institutions that are supporting slavery. And that's a very, very powerful piece of the speech. And ends with, that he comes back to this, the critique of American ideology. The inconsistency of American ideology.
How was the speech received, Paul, when he first delivered it?
It's my understanding that he received a standing ovation. I've seen some different pieces, and Jane may know more about that than I do, but it's my understanding that in that setting, it was relatively well received. But it's important to note, you know, after he became an abolitionist speaker, he was attacked several times, and in fact, one time his hand was broken, and that bothered him for the rest of his life. So, but my understanding is that audience was relatively receptive to what he had to say.
And Jane Williamson, do you have a sense of what he was hoping to achieve with a speech like that? Because as you pointed out, it certainly, or most likely, was not what the Ladies Anti-Slavery Association had anticipated hearing.
Oh, I say go ladies. One of the main things the abolitionists were trying to do for the 30 years before the Civil War, and initially when they started out, their main tactic was moral suasion. They were going to convert slave owners. And though there was never an official moment when they said, okay, we're dropping that, they really turned their attention to the Northern public opinion. And they understood that in a democracy, public opinion is kind of everything. I mean, certainly very powerful. So they really, that was their whole goal. And the speechifying, it's amazing how many lectures and lecturers and campaigns. And it was always toward trying to wake people up. Because to them, it was just so, you know, obvious and important. And so you just feel them constantly banging away. And I think, you know, I sometimes think, how could they, you know, 30 years, 35 years, it was a long time for them never to give up. And so in 1852, he was as, you know, determined as he had been in 1838 when he escaped. So
we're talking about Frederick Douglass today, learning a little bit more about him and about a speech that he delivered on the 5th of July in 1852, a speech that still resonates today. We're going to be talking a little bit about why Vermont communities are staging readings of that speech. Paul Marcus is going to share why this is so important to him to still continue looking at and reading and learning from today. And Jane Williamson at the Rokeby Museum is also going to tell us a little bit about Frederick Douglass's visit to Vermont nearly a decade before that speech, and how he was received here, not entirely well, as it turns out. You're listening to Vermont Edition, and if you have a question or a thought to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post on our page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're spending some time talking about Frederick Douglass. The noted abolitionist and former slave visited Vermont in 1843, speaking in Middlebury and Ferrisburg about the difficulties of being an escaped slave. Jane Williamson, executive director of the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg, is going to help us understand what impact he had on Vermonters. Douglass also gave a talk nearly 10 years later about why the 4th of July was not a moment of celebration for him and for many other slaves and former slaves. That speech made a splash at the time, and it still ripples today. 13 Vermont communities are taking part in the Reading Frederick Douglass Project, where they read that speech. Our other guest today, Paul Marcus, is the organizer of that project. And if you have a question about Frederick Douglass, or if you see a connection between his speech more than 150 years ago and today, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So Jane Williamson, take us back now to 1843. This is, again, almost a decade before the speech we've been talking about. At this time, Frederick Douglass is a fugitive slave. He has not yet had his freedom paid for him. So what was he doing in Vermont and how was he received?
Well, 1843, the 1840s were an interesting time. The abolitionist movement had started in the early 1830s and just took off. And as will often happen, after a while, as you gain more and more adherence in big social movements, little fissures will begin to appear. So it was a hard time. There had been splits and disagreements. So the Massachusetts abolitionists decided to re-abolitionize the North. They planned what they called the 100 conventions. They gathered up a cadre of speakers and they put the word out to everybody, if you'll organize a campaign or a convention or a meeting, we'll send you speakers. So Rowland Thomas Robinson at Rokeby said he wasn't going to let this opportunity go by and organized what the little poster called the Great Convention. So the beginning of the 100 conventions actually happened in Vermont. July of 1843, Douglass and George Bradburn, who was a state legislator from Massachusetts, and John Collins came into Vermont. They spoke in Middlebury. They spoke in Ferrisburg. In his last autobiography, he wrote three, Douglass talked about the 100 conventions and said what a bad reception they had gotten in Middlebury. There was some discussion of it in the press in Vermont about whether it was a real, what they would have called a mobbing, because there had been a lot of anti-abolitionist violence and mobbings. So he characterized it that way in his book, but others suggested that it was more in the category of hijinks. Evidently, the college students had a lot to do with it. And what sometimes happened is when an abolitionist lecturer was announced, the anti-folks would arrive early and fill up all the seats, or many of them. And I think that's what happened in Middlebury. They threw gravel. They threw eggs. They tried to interrupt the meeting, but nobody was injured, and I don't think there was any threat of violence.
But that may surprise some people who think of Vermont as a place of real tolerance, if not activism, at that time, and who may think of Middlebury College and remember that Middlebury College lays claim to having the first African-American graduate of a U.S. college in Alexander Twilight, who graduated 20 years before that.
Yes, well, life is complicated. Times are complicated. I mean, it's true that Vermont had a strong abolitionist movement. Our collection at Rokeby just has 1,000 examples of all of the efforts those folks put forth. But they were always a minority. And there was some anti-abolitionism in Vermont, as there was anywhere. I will say that it tended to be less of it in Vermont. I think there was more of a kind of let people think what they want, you know, laissez-faire, you know, I don't agree with them, but I'm not going to mess with them kind of attitude. But Douglass's speech is kind of interesting because it's similar in some ways to the 1852 speech, because he begins by calling out Vermont. And saying, you know, as much as you boast of republicanism, high as are your hills, low as are your dales, there is no place where Frederick Douglass can stand here as a free man, which was true, though not exactly Vermont's fault. But, you know, the experience in Middlebury, I think, for a lot of people is maybe surprising. And then there was some other newspaper coverage criticizing the whole both meetings, saying they're upsetters, they're going to ruin the country. I mean, back then, there was even fear of war. You know, if these people keep pushing and demanding and going in that direction, what's going to happen? Good question.
Yeah, and we saw what happened.
Exactly.
About 20 years later, 15 years later. Paul Marcus, that was 1843 in Vermont. Now here we are, 2015, and Vermont communities are restaging the speech that Frederick Douglass gave in 1852 about the meaning of the 4th of July. It's the second year that this has happened in Vermont. I think the third or fourth year you've been putting this on in Boston?
Oh, no, we've been doing it in Boston for about 12 years, although the large event started about 6 or 7 years ago. We began, and I was the executive director of an organization called Community Change, and we started the event as a brown bag in our library, and then it grew to this larger event.
So why do you think today it's valuable for us in our communities to not just know about Frederick Douglass, but to actually read this speech that he gave and read it out loud?
Well, you know, I always go back to the great James Baldwin. And there's a quote in the book, Fire Next Time. It's a letter to his nephew. And James Baldwin was a black writer and prophet, I would argue. And in this letter to his little 9-year-old nephew, he said that they, people who look like me, white people, are in effect still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they can understand it, they cannot be released from it. They've had to believe for innumerable years and for innumerable reasons that black men are inferior to white men. And, you know, I've been doing anti-racism work as an activist and a trainer and an educator for about 25 years now, and taught a class at Boston College for 16 years on the history and development of racism in the U.S. And I was always struck by, when we got to do about halfway through the semester, how angry the students were because they said, how come no one ever taught us this before? And so this is a longer conversation than we have time for now, but so it's my contention that we live in a racially illiterate country. And part of that is we also live in an ahistorical country. And so, you know, we've been talking about, and Douglass named this terrible contradiction at the founding of our country. And it's interesting. I can't tell you how many times, you know, we've been talking about these issues, and someone will, you know, say, why are you talking about slavery? That was in the past. Why don't you let go of the past? And this will be the same person who's going to be sitting out on the 4th of July, and what are they celebrating? So as a nation, we're very open to accepting that past that venerates us and elevates us. And on the reality, there's another side of that past that we haven't come to grips with as a nation, and that's the side of the genocide of the people who lived on this land and the enslavement of Africans to build this nation. And so part of it is to reconnect it with that, but it's also the thread of that system, and I would argue a system of white supremacy that is written into our Constitution. Blacks are three-fifths of a human being is one place, clearly, that says that. That's part of the fabric of who we are as a nation, and that's still with us, so that we are still operating. Much of my work is getting people to understand racism as a system, not something that not simply just prejudice and discrimination based on race, but as a system that's created when one group has the power to institutionalize its prejudices and make them into laws, policies, practices, and shape the culture. And it's that part of that cultural reality, which I believe is not seeing blacks and other people of color as fully human, that we're seeing playing out today on our streets. And we've been seeing, and what's been playing out on our streets in Baltimore and in Ferguson and in Charleston isn't anything new to African-American communities. That's part of the DNA of those communities. So that's their lived history. And the reality is that there's been no other group of people in the nation who have pushed this country to live to its stated ideals than African-Americans have. So my hope is that this will help people to connect with that history and understand the presence of that history. There's two outstanding books I would recommend to people if they want to read more about this. One is Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And another excellent book that's come out recently is called The Half That's Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism.
Let's go to Peggy, who's calling in from Craftsbury. Hi, Peggy. Go right ahead. Oh, let's see if we can grab Peggy on the air here.
Okay.
There you go, Peggy. We gotcha.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Peggy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. So thank you. I'm happy to be a little bit of a participant. I wanted to just express that on my own in terms of family history, I spent many years growing up in the deep south of Florida in the 40s. So what I'm seeing today here is very reminiscent of what one of my very wise professors from Queens College said, which is that we learn from history that we don't learn from history. And I'd like to suggest, yes, required reading, for any who want to be informed. The New Jim Crow is definitely one of them, but also the life and story of Frederick Douglass. I have a quote which I use all the time on my outgoing emails, one having to do with his famous quote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." He spoke that in 1857.
Peggy, wow, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. And Jane Williamson, as you listen to what Paul was saying about the connections he sees from the past all the way up to today, Peggy echoing that sentiment as well, what are your thoughts?
Well, I heard Zephyr Teachout on public radio say, I always look to history for hope.
Zephyr Teachout, a professor at Fordham University in New York, but also a former Vermonter, and she ran for governor. Yeah,
right,
go ahead.
Yeah. I always look to history for hope, and I was just like, yes, because you can look to history for hope, but you also have to look to history for other things. And I feel like in the history of Black Americans, there's a perpetual need. You get a little bit further ahead, and these systems of racism and whatever are very devious. And there was lynching in the early 20th century. Now there's this police, targeting. It just continues to express itself somehow. So I think we need to look to history for both hope and understanding how we got to be where we are right now.
We've been talking today about Frederick Douglass and talking a little bit about a speech, The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro. It's being staged in Vermont in 13 different communities. We've been talking with Paul Marcus. He's the organizer of Reading Frederick Douglass. And we have a link to all of the events in Vermont this week up at vpr.net. Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you. I'd like to note that there's 5 events happening today in Bennington, Brattleboro, Norwich, St. Johnsbury, and South Hero.
Good. All right. Go to vpr.net and you can find all of them and go to them. Jane Williamson is Executive Director of the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg. The Rokeby's event on Reading Frederick Douglass is on July 5th. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up, a profile of one Vermont man who committed suicide while incarcerated and why the community mental health system in the state proved inadequate to keep him out of prison. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In April of this year, a 34-year-old Vermont man took his life inside the Southern State Correctional Facility in Springfield. Patrick Fennessy had been in and out of prison since 2007 when he was convicted of a burglary charge, but his mental health issues contributed to his inability to stay out of prison. In a special report from VT Digger, the paper's criminal justice reporter Elizabeth Hewitt reveals how a lack of appropriate mental health treatment outside of the prison system kept Fennessy locked up after he could have been released. We spoke with Hewitt yesterday about her reporting.
Patrick Fennessy was convicted in 2007 on a charge of burglary and trespass. Patrick had grown up in southern Vermont, and he had had some encounters with legal troubles before that time, but the conviction that put him in prison was in 2007.
So Fennessy was also dealing with some pretty serious mental health issues, and some of them were apparent before he went to prison. Can you describe, as best you know it, what kind of conditions he was dealing with and how that affected his ability to get out and stay out of prison?
I spoke with Patrick Fennessy's older brother, James, who was 4 years his senior. And James said that his brother had started to show signs of mental illness when he was in his late teens. It's unclear to me exactly what his medical diagnosis might have been or if he did, in fact, have a medical diagnosis. But his brother had said that it's possible that he would have had bipolar disorder.
But it's safe to say that he was dealing with some pretty serious issues?
Yeah, but he certainly was. And family, as well as criminal justice professionals who knew him, recalled that he had attempted suicide several times outside of prison. And records that I found showed that he had attempted inside prison as well, as well as he had been on self-harm watch several times while he was in Southern State.
And he also was given the designation that's only in the prison system, and that's seriously functionally impaired. And there are quite a few, a couple hundred, maybe 100 to 200 prisoners mm-hmm. at any given time who have that designation. What does that mean for somebody in the prison system?
Right. So seriously functionally impaired, or they call it SFI, includes somebody who has severe bipolar, but it would also extend to somebody with dementia. Or with PTSD.
Or with a traumatic brain injury.
Or with a traumatic brain injury. So it really expands it to a host of different impairments, they call it, that would possibly affect the way that somebody would behave in the correctional setting. This is something that's useful for prison staff because SFI would sort of trigger that they would require some other attention. Patrick Fennessy, he had more difficulties than a lot of people.
So let's talk about how Patrick Fennessy's mental health issues actually contributed to him staying in prison longer than he should have, both not being able to get out when he could have, but also going back into the system. Why is that the case, that his mental health issues were what was causing him to stay in prison?
Right. So everybody that gets out of corrections will have a certain sort of review plan when they get out, you know, that they'll check in with a parole officer. There can be a range of different things.
Well, and things like they have to have a housing plan, and that has to fall within
right.
what their parole restrictions are, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Now, because of Patrick's needs, because of his mental health issues, he required more than just a roof and a bed. He needed to be receiving mental health treatment. He needed more supports than the average prisoner being released. And so the state has a process for that. And for the most serious cases, that involves people from the Department of Corrections working with people from other departments in the Agency of Human Services. So you have the Department of Mental Health, the Department of Health might be involved, Department of Disabilities, Aging and Independent Living. And all of these folks get together and see what services might be available within a particular community to suit this person's needs. Now, that happened for Patrick Fennessy. It actually happened on a few different occasions that they got together and they worked with local community partners down in the Springfield area, and they put together a plan that would hopefully give him the supports that he needed to thrive in the outside community. Unfortunately, it seemed that that plan was not sufficient, that he had been out, I think, in early 2012. He went back into prison on a violation related to drug or alcohol use. You know, you can violate parole that way. That might be a way to get back in. But then he was released again in December 2013. And this was after a year and a half of correction staff and different community players working to try to put together a support plan to keep him out in the community. He gets out in December 2013, and he was then back in prison in August. In that case, he had inadequate housing for his needs. People who knew him told me that he at that time was living in an apartment in Springfield, but that was not the Department of Corrections determined that he needed more than that. He needed a facility that he could receive mental health treatment, and that was for his safety and for other people's safety as well.
So was the determination through your reporting or from the people that you talked to that the services weren't available all in one community that could actually have helped Patrick Fennessy and helped follow that plan of wraparound care that he was required to have?
There are a lot of services. Let me start by saying that there are many services available in the Springfield area. There are all over Vermont. But part of the problem is that there really aren't sufficient supports for the number of people that need to draw on them and for the intensity with which they might need it. So for Patrick, in Patrick's case, he went back on a housing violation and he stayed in prison. And while people he knew out in the community and he himself were looking for places that might be able to take him. But repeatedly they were hearing from different facilities, mental health facilities, that no, his needs were too acute that they wouldn't be able to provide that. So I think it does come down to partially is that our system, our community-based healthcare system, which is what the state switched to from the state hospital, that in a way it's stretched too thin to be able to serve all of the people that require services. And so in a way this is still a rather new system. And when I spoke to different folks who work in the Agency of Human Services, there was sort of an attitude that this is something that we're still learning. We are still figuring out what capacity we need as a state to serve this population.
Yeah, you speak with Dr. Dolores Burrows Byron in your article, and she's the head of health services for the Department of Corrections. And she pointed out that DOC is really one of the primary mental health providers in the state, and in fact, one of the most comprehensive mental health providers in the state.
Certainly. And while we have this community-based system, we have many different players that are able to offer different services to different people in different towns and regions. But in a way, a prison is one of the only places in the state that can offer everything in one place and make sure that somebody with a criminal background is safe and secure and also receiving treatment. And that's an unusual situation in our state at this time.
Patrick Fennessy did commit suicide in prison. Did you get a sense from the people you were talking to that better mental health care services either inside or outside of prison could have helped him?
People that I spoke to who knew him recalled that in the months before his death, he seemed to be on the improvement, that he had gone several months without having a serious attempt. He had recently been moved out of a unit in Southern State that's specifically for mental health patients. He had been moved from there to a general population unit. He had a roommate at the time. So even though he had a long history of self-harm and of suicide attempts, it caught a lot of people who knew him by surprise because he did seem to be improving.
You talked with several people who really cared about Patrick Fennessy in your article and who were devastated by his suicide. And it's a very sad story that you tell. Do you see any broader lessons in his story?
I think that Patrick Fennessy's story it's unique in how tragic it is, but he certainly is not the only person in the Department of Corrections who has a similar story. There are, according to the Department of Corrections, 44% of men in the Vermont prison system and 70% of women receive some form of mental health treatment while they're incarcerated. And that's a huge number of people. Now, not everybody is as severe as Patrick Fennessy, but there's a crossroads between when somebody gets out of the Department of Corrections and when they get into the community and they suddenly start working with all of these other departments that provide human services, all of the players aren't necessarily able to connect in a way that they are fully able to serve. I spoke to a lot of people who talked about how hardworking and devoted a lot of the people in all of these different departments are to their jobs. It's not necessarily a failing of the people who are working there. It seems that there's something in our system that is not able to meet the full capacity that we require.
Elizabeth Hewitt is the criminal justice reporter for VT Digger. We have a link to her story on Patrick Fennessy up at vpr.net. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
And we end today with music from the Vermont band Medela. When this band came in to perform on VPR's music series Live from the Fort, they did their sound check, and then they changed into their signature Technicolor spandex attire. That gives you a sort of visual cue to their music, which might best be described as neon pop dance rock. Here's Medela with the song I Know.
A new beginning is free of doubt. Echo, good as I'm creating. Lately, all the pressure here is dissipating. Breathe out, breathe in, feel sustained. Ooh, I know that you, I know, I know that you can make a difference. You call my phone. I know that you. Satisfaction making choices on my own. Man, headache, mind was tangled up in confusion. Who and what I should be trusting. Darkest days in. I don't want to live without you. I don't want to live without you. I don't want to live. I don't want to live. I don't want to live without you. I don't want to live without you. I don't want to live. I don't want to live without you. live without you. I don't want to live without you.
That's the Vermont band Medela singing I Know. The music video of their performance on VPR's Live from the Fort is online at vpr.net. And be sure to listen this Friday at noon when VPR presents a special compilation of the great music we've heard so far in the series. But before you get to that, gym classes are trading in classic games like dodgeball and climbing the rope. For what? Well, skiing maybe, or swim lessons. Vermont's physical educators are now hoping to build lifelong health habits, not hang-ups about being picked last for kickball. Tomorrow, we'll talk about Vermont's new standards for physical education and health classes in public schools. And you can send your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net. Then tune in tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.